The Obama administration tried to finalize a rule that clarifies the Clean Water Act. Farmers and builders didn't like it, and neither does President Trump.
With today's executive order, I'm directing the EPA to take action, paving the way for the elimination of this very destructive and horrible rule.
I'm Kara Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're looking at the future of the Waters of the U.S. rule, which impacts the drinking water of millions of Americans. Plus, some people really love unseasonably high temperatures.
I'll take warm weather in February any year, and in January, and in December.
For others, a mild winter equals climate change angst. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Ticks don't wait until spring to become active. 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young reports from Pittsburgh, a warm snap in western Pennsylvania could mean more breeding ticks and cases of Lyme disease.
Pennsylvania has had the highest rate of Lyme disease in the nation for years, and that number is going up. More than 12,000 cases were reported last year, one-third the total cases of Lyme disease across the country. Pennsylvania Department of Health's April Hutchison says that's partly due to a high deer population, which transmits the disease through ticks, and lots of forested land.
Well, I think there's also a larger awareness of Lyme disease and getting tested for Lyme disease. And so as we become more aware, we do expect those numbers to increase as more residents are finding signs and symptoms and getting tested.
Lyme disease has been detected in all of Pennsylvania's 67 counties. Hutchison says it's important to take preventative actions against ticks year-round, including during unseasonably warm times. She says the most effective prevention methods are using DEET, wearing long pants and sleeves, and seeking early treatment if bites are detected. I'm Virginia Alvino Young, 90.5 WESA News.
Record high temperatures this winter have some people sweating about climate change. Weather isn't the same as climate, but 60 and 70 degree days in late February broke records all over the Northeast, and it's part of an overall trend of more record high temperatures than lows. We asked some people in downtown Pittsburgh what they think of balmy winter days. Heath Cameron called it heavenly.
I'll take warm weather in February any year, and in January, and in December. Anything above 50, closer to 90 is even better. I have concerns about global warming, but if this is the effect of it in this area, then that's okay.
But Aaron McCormick said a 70-degree day last week was just strange.
Although I do enjoy temperatures being warmer and I enjoy being able to be outside, I do think that it's a wake-up call. What's it going to be like years from now? How bad is it going to get? You know, are the glaciers going to melt in Antarctica? And then what?
Well, fears about the uncertainty of climate change were on Michael Swoboda's mind recently. He's a former bookseller and now a writing professor at the George Washington University. And he compiled a reading list about climate and psychology for Yale Climate Connections, kind of a climate change information clearinghouse. I talked with Swoboda by phone about some of the titles on the list.
Well, I love the subheadings that you've given the list. The first is denial, depression, melancholia. Which of the books from that group stand out for you?
So if I had to sort these over again, I might do it somewhat differently. But in this list, there are books addressing the anxiety provoked by climate change and strategies that people may adopt to respond to that anxiety. And so the first deals with denial.
Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, mm-hmm. and Everyday Life. That's by Carrie Marie Norgaard. The winter of 2000-2001, the first snowfall came 2 months late, made ice fishing very impossible. The ski industry had to respond and make artificial snow. She describes the people there as being, you know, politically savvy, people who understand the concept of climate change, but they were in a state of denial that this was happening.
If you can't think of a way to solve the problem, you may ignore that it exists. And this is Norwegians who kind of, in this case, somewhat depend on cold weather for their livelihoods. We're nevertheless overlooking the changes in their climate. The other two are broader. I say the third, the environmental melancholia, is an attempt to deal with the sorrow that someone might feel that the world that they knew, the nature that they knew, is changing, that our relationship with nature is changing in a way that can be discomforting and also may entail more responsibility than previously.
That book is Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement, with Renee Lertzman.
Right. And so she's going to argue that we need to go through a period of mourning before we're going to be able to sort of enact a new relationship with nature. So if I had to sort of regroup this list into psychological concerns, I would say there are four basic psychological concerns that are being addressed. And in many cases, some of these books are dealing with all of them. Some are dealing more with one over the other. Mm-hmm. But there's first the cognitive psychological concern, which is, why do we have such a hard time thinking about climate change? And that's been out there for a while. Climate change communicators have recognized that climate change is exactly the opposite to the kind of problems that our brains are wired to respond to quickly, immediately, and decisively. It's remote, it's distant in time, it's slow. And then there are ways that we can fool ourselves into ignoring a problem with various kinds of avoidance mechanisms. Then there's the problem of anxiety. What happens if you actually acknowledge that this is a reality, but it's a reality that's hard to do something about and actually depends on a lot of other people besides yourself, and you have to figure out how you're going to stay sane, stay confident, stay active in the face of what could seem an overwhelming and insurmountable problem. Then there's trauma. And this is people who have gone through an extreme weather event like Hurricane Sandy. Those people are left with genuine trauma and have to figure out how they're going to work through that, the real destruction of their lives and the realization that nature can be a force of that much destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, there's a kind of eco-psychology angle, and we've touched on that a little bit, which is basically to say that contemporary Western technologized society has cut us off from nature, and so we don't consider it a part of our world. We don't consider it as having an ethical claim on us, and we consequently overlook when we are doing things to it that will ultimately rebound to our own damage.
Well, some of these books are geared towards psychologists or people with a scientific background.
Right.
But if you don't know much about Jung or object relations, which of these titles is really accessible for the general reader?
Coming of Age at the End of Nature, A Generation Faces Living on a Changed Planet was a book put together by Trinity University Press where they asked young people how they were thinking about the problem of climate change and how they were integrating it into their own lives and into their politics, all millennials.
And so is there a marked difference between what they're saying and what others have said in the past about facing climate change?
I think there's a greater acceptance of it as a problem. There's probably more optimism, possibly due just to the optimism of youth. I think they've been exposed to this long enough that they see that there are ways of dealing with it.
You know, initially when I reached out to you about talking about this list, I was very surprised at how many titles there are on the topic of psychology and mm-hmm. climate change. I guess, is this a growing field of research? And also, you know, is it a surprise that there are so many titles that you can put in a list like this?
I was surprised. The cynical answer to the question would be we have a problem that we're going to be living with pretty much hereafter. And so every discipline is at some point going to grapple with it. And that means we're going to have more and more books from more and more specialized angles about climate change.
Is that the cynical one?
That's the cynical one.
What's the positive one? we're embracing all of our emotions for this topic.
The positive one is there is a recognition that dealing with climate change is as much a social, psychological, behavioral problem as it is a scientific/technological problem. And so we are getting books that are dealing with the human psyche as a big part of the equation of climate change. And that is both how do you get humans to change their behavior, which is a good thing. And on the other side, there's a growing recognition that this is already happening and it is having impacts. I think both sides of that equation are a much more realistic assessment of where we are and what we need to do. And therefore, it's a good sign that there are these books coming out.
Michael Swoboda is an assistant professor of writing at the George Washington University, where he teaches environmental communication. You can find a link to his suggestions for books about climate and psychology and some of his other reading lists at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. This year's mild winter has some food producers on edge. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has been talking with fruit growers and maple syrup producers in the region.
March is usually prime season for boiling the sap from maple trees down into syrup. But Nathan Goodell says his family's farm started in early February.
We finished tapping our trees the very beginning of February and made our first syrup on the 7th of February, which is the earliest we've ever boiled syrup.
I visited on March 1st, when you'd expect the Goodells' tubing lines from the trees to be running lots of sap to the sugar shack, but there wasn't much action. Most years at this time, they're gearing up for maple production. Instead, they're winding down.
And this year, we're going to finish about as early as we ever have, it looks like.
And it's not just maple syrup that's affected by the mild winter. Orchards are also off the regular growing season. Plum and apricot trees are already close to blooming. That's a month ahead of schedule. Some growers expect to lose those crops.
The danger is we may get a frost.
Rich Marini is a fruit tree specialist at Penn State University. He says if temperatures dip below about 28 degrees, fruit trees that have flowered could be in trouble.
So if we get a frost when they're in bloom, it kills the flower. And the flower contains the developing fruit.
But Marini says Pennsylvania's major fruit crops, apples and peaches, haven't soaked in too much sunshine yet.
I like the warm weather, but for the trees, you know, I'd like it to stay in the 40s during March, or even the low 50s at least, to delay bloom if we could.
He says apple trees, for example, have been blooming earlier over the past 25 years or so. And this year looks to be ahead of schedule, even by recent standards. Still, apples might be able to delay budding until spring really arrives.
Don't give up hope yet. You know, right now, I'm assuming we're going to get a crop. So we'll see. We just never know.
Back at Nathan Goodell's farm, maple production is looking a little short of an average season. His farm is a stop on an annual March Maple Madness tour. But visitors won't see the sugar shack in full swing since most of the work is done. Instead, Goodell's visitors will just have to be content with working their way through a stack of pancakes. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Spring is just around the corner, and soon we'll be waking to the tweets and chirps of birds. But not from this spring migrant. Sound more like a garbage disposal? Well, this species kind of is. Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, more about the bird that does our dirty work. Stay tuned. Pennsylvania has rapidly become a major hub for the development of new natural gas pipelines. In recent weeks, projects worth billions have been approved by state and federal regulators. Shortly after he took office, Governor Tom Wolf convened a large task force to recommend ways to coordinate planning and best practices for this building boom. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, a year later, it appears the report has been largely ignored.
The governor's pipeline infrastructure task force had problems from the beginning. For one thing, it was really big, with close to 150 members. For another, they had a pretty hard time agreeing on anything. There were representatives from industry, government, academia, and environmental groups, and they weren't exactly all on the same page. Finally, the public meetings were often disrupted by protesters. At the last meeting, about a year ago, seven people were arrested.
Task force!
The whole effort was spearheaded by then-Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, John Quigley. At the group's final meeting, he said the report is just a first step, and the state's work on pipelines should continue.
Again, this is the start of a conversation, and it's fertile ground. I really do honestly believe that this is a very fertile document that can generate a lot of positives.
Among the report's 184 recommendations were calls to do things like increase public participation and planning, beef up pipeline safety requirements, and coordinate permitting. Senator Andy Dinneman, a Democrat from Chester County, spoke up and said he was disappointed. He didn't think anyone in the legislature had even heard of it.
Much of this is going to require legislative action.
If the pipeline task force is to have any relevance, Dinneman said, the report should be shared widely with the legislature.
Otherwise, it gets put, like all task force reports, gets put on a shelf somewhere.
A few months later, Quigley lost his job, and with his departure, it appears much of the work stopped. Dan Devlin hasn't talked to anyone about it in about a year. He heads the Bureau of Forestry at the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and he was on the task force.
I haven't personally followed up either. I probably should have as well.
His agency is still doing things it was already doing, like trying to co-locate pipelines with existing right-of-ways and monitoring for the threat of invasive species. But he praises the task force for giving him a chance to meet a lot of people from diverse backgrounds.
I think that was one of the big things, is that we all kind of got to see what each other was doing and, you know, kind of learn from each other.
So what have other agencies done with the recommendations?
That's a great question.
Denise Brinley was on the task force, too, representing the State Department of Community and Economic Development.
I think that, as you know, that report was very dense and it contained a lot of information.
But much of her job is focused on trying to get Marcellus Shale resources to be used within the state. And she says right now, most of the products are leaving Pennsylvania's borders. Meanwhile, others see the state's role as basically getting out of the way.
If these pipelines don't go forward, that all the prosperity that the gas resource can bring to Pennsylvania is delayed or stopped.
That's Representative John Marr, a Republican from Allegheny County. He wasn't on the task force, but he chairs the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee. He says he's pleased with Patrick McDonnell, who replaced Quigley as DEP head. In the past few weeks, the agency's issued permits for two major pipelines. Marr's hopeful that will continue, but he worries rank-and-file staff could slow things down.
Sometimes the sailors on the ship don't care much what the captain thinks, and we'll see in this case whether the sailors are paying attention to the captain or not.
For his part, as captain or acting DEP secretary, Patrick McDonnell says the agency is addressing the task force's recommendations. He says an internal working group is handling it and points to a new web portal they created to be a hub of information on pipelines.
Pushing out some more on the public participation front has been a biggie. And there were a number of recommendations within that regard in particular.
Indeed, one of the few things the whole task force agreed on was that pipeline projects need better public relations. And how well is that going? It's debatable. Just ask Robin McGuire. She's part of a group in Lancaster County that opposes the Atlantic Sunrise gas pipeline. The project was recently approved by federal regulators. The group has started an encampment and plans to engage in nonviolent direct action to disrupt construction.
We have people from Standing Rock in. We're finalizing plans. We're going to make some noise. They're going to pay attention to us.
Meanwhile, gas industry representatives who served on the task force say they found it to be a frustrating and unwieldy process, and they don't expect much to come of it. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's been another whirlwind week in the Trump administration, and the Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant is here with me to talk about one particular environmental piece of it. Because President Trump made his first official address to Congress, and he surprised some by adding this phrase in his list of things he plans to do.
And to promote clean air and clean water, and to rebuild our military and our infrastructure.
Right. The comment was surprising because just hours earlier, Trump signed an executive order seeking to undo the Waters of the U.S. rule that was created to protect the nation's waterways from pollution.
It's a horrible, horrible rule. Has sort of a nice name, but everything else is bad. I've been hearing about it for years and years. I didn't know I'd necessarily be in this position to do something about it, but we've been hearing about it for years. With today's executive order, I'm directing the EPA to take action, paving the way for the elimination of this very destructive and horrible rule.
So the Waters of the United States rule, Julie, you've done a lot of reporting on this. What is it?
Well, it was issued in 2015, and it was supposed to clarify which waterways are regulated under the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, the Obama administration's EPA said the need for this rule was obvious. People need clean water. And without the new clean water rule, more than 100 million Americans, that's one in three, would get drinking water from waterways that aren't currently protected from pollution.
And the EPA says the rule would protect 60% of the nation's streams and millions of acres of wetlands that flow into rivers, lakes, bays, coastal waters, all the places where we get drinking water and water for other human uses, as well as wildlife habitat.
So why did the EPA put out this rule when it did in 2015?
So to get to that, it's worth looking back to see how we got to this point. Ever since the Clean Water Act was created by Congress in 1972, there's been a question of which waterways should be regulated by the federal government.
Right. At first, they said only navigable waterways.
Yeah. So a river, a lake, or another body of water that could be used for commerce, so a boat could travel on it carrying goods. But over time, and mostly through the courts, that definition has been expanded. There was one significant Supreme Court case decided in 2001. There, the court said isolated wetlands, those that aren't connected to larger bodies of water, were not under federal jurisdiction and could not be regulated by the EPA.
And then what happened in the 2006 case?
Yeah, that's the other big one. That's known as the Rapanos case. And in that one, the Supreme Court actually did not come to a majority opinion over what should be regulated. But it was also in that case where Justice Kennedy wrote about something he called a significant nexus.
Meaning any waterway that's connected with a navigable waterway could be regulated.
Kind of. It's a term that's been debated a lot, and it's also what the EPA used as its guidance when writing the Waters of the U.S. rule, which, as we said, was finalized in 2015 after years of evaluating more than 1,200 scientific studies and more than a million public comments on the issue.
This topic is the subject of our latest podcast, Trump on Earth. Julie and I talked to Politico's Annie Snyder, who specializes in the Clean Water Act, to find out more about the rule. Here's a piece of the podcast where we ask Annie why this rule was created.
There has been massive confusion since these two Supreme Court decisions about what is and isn't covered under the Clean Water Act. And that really matters to everybody. That matters to developers, to anybody who might need a permit to impact one of these waters that's covered, because they just don't know. So if you are a home builder and you want to build a suburban development, you're going to need a permit to impact the wetlands and streams in your way. And so you want to know, is this project going to be viable? Are there a lot of wetlands there? Is it going to be really expensive for me to get this permit? So they wanted clarity about which wetlands are covered, which streams are covered by the Clean Water Act. At the same time, environmental groups and local municipalities that provide drinking water and are responsible for protecting water in their jurisdictions have also wanted clarity so that they can know what's protected, so that they can know if they need to be concerned about their sources of drinking water.
You know, during President Obama's last week in office, the EPA and Army Corps of Engineers filed a 300-page legal and scientific defense of this rule, and I just wonder where all that information goes if the current administration doesn't like the rule.
Yeah, sure. So, it makes the job of repealing the rule all that much harder. So fundamentally, if the Trump administration wants to revamp this rule, then they're going to have to go through a new formal rulemaking process. And the reason that's important is that that can be challenged in court by people who want to protect the rule. And I'm talking about the Obama rule there. So, if the Trump administration says we want to withdraw this and we're at least going to get the Obama rule off the books, and then maybe we'll go through and do our own rulemaking down the road, then there is an opportunity for environmental groups to sue. So even if the Trump administration doesn't want to defend the Obama administration rule, then environmental groups in states like maybe California or New York, where attorneys general have been very active on environmental issues, maybe they decide they want to sue and say, you have to explain why you are going to withdraw this rule that we think was a good rule. And all of that scientific and legal defense that's been on the books, and there's the 300-page document that you talked about that was filed just before the Obama administration left office. But there was also thousands of pages of scientific evidence that were compiled as part of the rulemaking process. And the Trump administration is going to have to contend with all of that as they try and justify why this rule is not justifiable.
Annie Snyder covers the Clean Water Act for Politico. There's much more of this conversation about the Waters of the U.S. rule.
And what President Trump's order to revamp it might mean. Check it out on our new podcast. It's called Trump on Earth. and you can find it on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thanks, Julie. That's the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant. We're also at TrumpOnEarth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Well, as we've noted, winter wasn't very frosty or snowy this year. That could make the job easier for nature's early spring cleanup crew. Turkey vultures are just starting to make their way back to our region. Usually, their spring migration is just in time to take care of the defrosting carcasses that have been frozen over the winter. Kate St. John explains.
Turkey vultures, sometimes called buzzards, are large, dark, hawk-like birds with long, broad wings that often soar in groups. Vultures may have a bad name, especially to the uninformed, because they eat rotted meat. The smellier, the better. Circling overhead, they can smell a carcass hidden by trees. Once found, a wake of vultures soon gathers for the feast. This is the only time you may hear them. They're quiet, except when they're fighting over food. Turkey vultures are good at finding bad odors like the rotten egg smell of natural gas. Energy companies out west used to watch where vultures congregated to locate leaks in their pipelines. Vultures' eating habits are helpful, too. They can devour anthrax-infected animals because their powerful stomachs protect them. When the vulture cleanup crew eats a carcass, they remove dangerous toxins from the environment, saving the rest of us from exposure to really dangerous stuff. But even vultures have limits. They can't eat frozen food. So turkey vultures travel south in the fall for warmer climes. On peak days in October, 150,000 of them can pass the Veracruz Hawk Watch on Mexico's Gulf Coast. They fly back in March when their breeding instincts kick in. Look for them overhead now, but it will take some observation to tell them apart from hawks or eagles. There are two big clues to help you out. Turkey vultures soar with their wings held in a shallow V called a dihedral, and they teeter side to side in the air. They hold their wings stiff, rarely flapping, and rock from side to side to make course corrections. So if you see a large, dark, hawk-like bird making lazy circles in the sky, look for the teetering and its wings held in a shallow V. The V is for vulture. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kate St. John.
Those ghastly hisses of the turkey vultures were provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They kind of sound like an old refrigerator I used to have. You can find a link to Kate St. John's birding blog outside my window at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Our podcast, Trump on Earth, is produced with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. More at pointpark.edu. And thanks to graduate students Rebecca Lesner and Ashley Murray for their help on the show this week. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.